This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today, we'll start our show talking with an expert about PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and disorder, I should say. And we'll talk with Dr. Lori Nedell, who is an author and is an expert in this field. And we're going to talk about the nature of PTSD. And Ashley Thornburg joins me in studio. And Dr. Nedell is by phone from Florida as we speak. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
June is PTSD Awareness Month. So let's start with a definition. What is PTSD?
PTSD is actually when a normal person has normal reactions to an abnormal situation. This is a syndrome that we normally associate with veterans, but in fact millions and millions of people in the United States struggle with this, especially as there is turbulence in the environment and there's an increase in all sorts of disasters. And so PTSD is kind of a delayed stress reaction that can start 6 months after experiencing or witnessing a life-threatening or dangerous event.
And what drew you to study this disorder?
My first career was in journalism, and I was a reporter for United Press International and Newsweek in Santiago, Chile, during the state of siege, which was back in 1974. And as a result of one of my sources reporting me to the military junta, I had to leave the country in a hurry. I went into hiding, and I had to, rather than show up for my scheduled appointment or meeting with the head of the Air Force. So when I got back to the United States, I was working at the United Nations, and about 6 months, 8 months later, I found myself underneath my bed, kind of in a fetal position, because a truck had gone over a manhole cover, and I thought, my body thought it was machine gun fire. Hmm. So at that time, there wasn't much information, but I had definitely written stories about veterans returning from Vietnam who had this condition, and I did go for some mental health counseling. And so it was something that intrigued me, and I changed careers in the late 1980s after 20 years in the news business. And as I was studying cognitive psychology, I decided to specialize in PTSD because I was aware that it was something that did affect civilians from my own experience.
Do we know why there is a delay? Because it can be months, sometimes even years, after the initial trauma.
That's a really good question, and I think it's kind of a mystery to science. Some people will process, or what we call resolve, the immediate acute stress reactions, which are similar if not identical to PTSD, and they come up in the first 2 to 3 months or immediately after a traumatic event. And I think for most people, they probably resolve on their own. But for many people, the onset comes 6 months after the event because that's at a point where things have started to normalize and stabilize. And then the deeper emotions start to come up to the surface. Because when we are close to a trauma or we experience something traumatic or witness it, and we can witness it on our screens, we can be traumatized by watching disturbing images on our screens, we tend to put it away because these images or these memories or the smell, if you're directly in contact with that particular event, can be very disturbing, and we often need to make critical decisions or survival decisions when we're still in a state of shock. And so the brain kind of files it away in a drawer, and we just keep going, and, you know, we live our life, and then as things seem to kind of settle down, the drawer flies open, and the subconscious mind says, okay, now we have to deal with these feelings.
Well, you have a unique situation as somebody who deals with PTSD because you have experienced it. Can you describe how that affects the way you work on treatment?
You know, that's an excellent question. I write about it in my book, The Five Gifts, Discovering Hope, Healing, and Strength When Disaster Strikes. I know that having PTSD because it is something that occasionally comes back in the form of flashbacks when I see certain events on the news. It allows me to establish a kind of empathic connection with somebody or with a group, because in kind of revealing or in disclosing that I have lived with this condition off and on for many years, it gives me a credibility, kind of like a drug counselor who is a former addict. So it kind of gives me street credibility with people. Very often when people have gone through something like a tornado or a fire or a hurricane or a car accident, the intensity of the symptoms of PTSD can make it difficult for anyone who hasn't been through it to understand, because it's not something that appears clearly as a clinical picture, like somebody who's depressed, who may be sad for persistently, or a sense of hopelessness. It's an anxiety disorder, which means that your body is in a state of anticipation, like waiting for the next shoe to drop. And most of the time, people can function with that, but it feels disturbing in your body. So somebody who's been through it understands that.
It was interesting to me that when you gave the definition, you used the word normal twice. Normal people who are having a normal reaction to an abnormal situation. So I just want to know about the importance of using the word normal when you talk about PTSD.
It's important to know that anybody, even a professional, even a first responder, can be physically or viscerally disturbed, upset, haunted by a disturbing scene of usually a scene of violence of some kind, a sudden violent change in your surroundings, or a sudden violent change to people. I'd like to use the example of September 11th, which traumatized us as a nation, and certainly those of us who live in New York City have been traumatized repeatedly by seeing the images and seeing the memory, but basically the visual reminders that are kind of part of the city landscape. So it's not, for example, it's something that can happen to anyone at any time. That's why I use the word normal.
Well, let's get into the sort of the numbers here, because you talk about combat veterans exhibiting some symptoms of this, and first responders, perhaps, and survivors of natural disasters, and lots of people. How prevalent is PTSD? Do we know how many victims there are?
Well, I don't think of them as victims. I think of them as survivors.
Okay.
One of the things is that we're helpless to prevent these events, and I think the helplessness is one of the triggers or causes of these reactions. The existing statistics until very recently said that I think it was 13% of Americans will report some kind of post-traumatic stress reaction, and that 13%, we're talking about civilians. I think the percentage for women is higher than men because women tend to seek help. But according to the National Wildlife Foundation, there was a study that said that more than 200 million Americans will be traumatized as the result of extreme weather events, as you're seeing now, as we're seeing tornadoes and floods that are unprecedented. We're seeing millions of people losing everything. And we're now at the beginning of hurricane season on the East Coast, in Florida especially. We have an increase in human disasters called intentional disasters, like mass shootings. So at least 200 million Americans are expected to have been traumatized or have mental health disturbances due to exposure to climate events by the year 2025. That's just 5 or 6 years away. So it is really becoming a national epidemic among civilians, and it needs to be addressed.
Well, that's half the population of the United States,
that's right.
roughly. So are there degrees of PTSD? I mean, they're like depression or something like that. Are there various – does it go from mild to severe?
Yes, I would say that's an excellent question. It definitely does go from mild to severe. Sometimes, you know, people will have a kind of mild sense of, helplessness and dread are two of the kind of criteria for the immediate reaction. You're helpless to prevent something from happening that is life-threatening or in which, human life is lost. And it can also, as I said, it can also be due to exposure to images on your screen, digital screen or television screen. So in those cases where people are witnesses, the reactions can range from mild to severe. But I would say that for most people, it tends to resolve naturally on its own within a few months, and there may be some residual effects that can come up, as I said, after 6 months in the form of dreams or an occasional flashback when, say, for example, when I lost my home in Hurricane Sandy in 2012, and when I watch hurricane or flood footage, I tend to have flashbacks. I get knots in my stomach, and my breathing kind of gets tight, and I realize that I'm empathically connecting to those people who are suffering because of that natural disaster.
We humans like to do that a lot of times too, where we do things that aren't good for us. We crave unhealthy food. We drive by car accidents and, you know, what they call rubbernecking, like look at this big traumatic thing. And then with screens, people are glued to this, like right in their laps. What is your suggestion for just the image portion of fighting PTSD? Is it best to try to avoid looking at these images? Is that even possible?
Well, I don't think it's possible because even say I suggest to people, and the American Red Cross will tell people after a disaster to turn off the screens and take a news break. As I say, take a news break, 24 to 48 hours. Don't look at those images until you feel calmer. Especially if you're a survivor of an ongoing event like tornadoes or floods, you don't need to be watching it, you know, all the time, because you have to make critical survival decisions while you're in a state of shock. I think that it's a dilemma because, on the one hand, there's this curiosity, and it's important to be well-informed. And on the other hand, there are the disturbing reactions that we can have from watching something like, for example, the Parkland shooting aftermath, where it affects us physically. People will get nauseous. I mean, there's a certain amount of grief, of crying. There's anxiety. There's apprehension. There's a feeling that you're unsafe in your own skin. And it's important to be able to turn off the images when they're triggering intense, unpleasant reactions. However, it's also important that we stay connected with each other, because one of the triggers of severe PTSD is isolation. So when people have been through something that's life-altering, there's a tendency to pull away from other people and just kind of shut down. And that's dangerous. It can lead to depression, substance abuse, and even suicide. So we need to stay connected. We need to see what's going on. And we need to really cultivate, you know, one of the five gifts is empathy. We really are suffering from long-term empathy, which is what we need after a major event.
Dr. Lori Nadel is a specialist in stress, trauma, and anxiety, and she's the author of a book, The Five Gifts, Discovering Hope, Healing, and Strength When Disaster Strikes. June is PTSD Awareness Month, and you have experience dealing with people who've been through traumatic events. Can you take us through the treatment protocol for somebody who comes to you for help?
Well, the first thing that I will do when somebody comes to me for help is showing that person emotional first aid tools, which I've developed and which are in my book, The Five Gifts. And one of the easiest, and if anybody is listening who's just been through the horror of a tornado or flood or aftermath, the easiest thing is to check in with your body and to notice if there's anywhere that you're experiencing any stress or tension or anxiety, and close your eyes and just breathe in and focus on those areas of your body that are disturbed, and mentally, internally ask yourself, what color would help you to feel better? And whatever color comes into your mind, because remember, you are also in a state of shock, so this needs to work very quickly. You take a deep breath, focus on, say, your chest or knots in your stomach, and ask in your head and in your mind, ask what color would help me to feel better, and then inhale that color and feel the wave of color kind of blending with the oxygen molecules and hitching a ride through your bloodstream and finding its way anywhere in your body that would like to feel relaxed and calm. And then as you exhale, breathe out anything you want to get rid of, any stress, any pain, any tension, any disturbance. Breathe it out, exhale a different color. And as you inhale that soothing color and exhale anything you want to release from your body, it will take the edge off any kind of anxiety or panic or even flashback.
There are some yogic elements to your treatment.
Yes and no. You don't really have to concentrate on this. So yoga, you have to concentrate on the type of breathing, and you have to count. And when you're in a state of shock or when you're having a flashback or you're kind of feeling the onset of a panic attack, this needs to work quickly and without thinking. It works much more quickly than yoga, because you don't have to be mindful or think about it.
But this is talking with somebody. This is direct communication about the issue, about my problem and how I might work my way through it?
It can be in a one-on-one session. I've given workshops to several hundred teachers at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, where I have shared these techniques, and the teachers have used them with themselves and with the students, who obviously get triggered every time there's a fire drill bell, and as do many of the teachers and staff who were there on the day of the shooting. So it can be one-on-one, or it can be, as I've just talked to your audience, somebody listening may be able to just start breathing in that soothing color right now and breathing out anything that they want to get rid of by breathing out a different color.
Can PTSD be cured?
That's a very interesting question. Yes and no. People I've spoken to are first responders, for example. They can get triggered years later, even though they have to learn how to cope with the immediate reactions after a particularly disturbing call, which usually involves the death of children. When they're not able to rescue a child. So let's say years later something happens, or they see something on television, or they hear about something from a colleague, they could have a flashback and re-experience the sense of helplessness and dread that they felt at that particular call. It tends to kind of live in the brain. But sometimes someone described it as a retrovirus. So if all of our emotions are stored as molecules, which they are, everything is stored in the emotional brain or the limbic system, and that includes pleasurable memories like the smell of turkey baking or the smell of brownies baking, and that smell can trigger a release of the chemicals of pleasure and remembering what it was like to be at your grandmother's table and a sense of enjoyment. Or those chemicals can release a sense of helplessness and dread, because the trauma molecules are stored the same way that the pleasure molecules are stored. It depends on what the triggers are.
There's a Gallup poll that shows that Americans in particular seem to be experiencing PTSD and other anxiety conditions at higher levels than the rest of the world. Sometimes numbers like this are associated with awareness. We might be more aware, and that's why those numbers are higher. We have more treatment options. Maybe those numbers are higher. But also there is sort of the element of the lifestyle and everything that's happening in that country. What is it, if there's an easy answer to this, about American life and society that might be contributing to these higher numbers?
Well, the numbers show that the United States is like number four, and there are a number of countries where 55% of people report a high level of stress and anxiety. And I can, off the top of my head, I know one is Iran and one is Sri Lanka, and I forget what the other nation is. And we're all at like 55%. And I think Greece is the highest at 59% because of the political and economic instability. And I know that, you know, as a culture, we're not used to uncertainty and instability. And right now, we're in a very turbulent cycle. And, you know, the political scene is unpredictable. There is an increase in all types of disasters, natural disasters, environmental disasters like toxic chemical leaks, and what they call intentional disasters, which are acts of random violence and mass shooting. And all of these are on the increase. And one of the things that people reported as a concern now is safety. And when you don't feel safe in your environment, when everything is very unstable and unpredictable, it does cause that chemical reaction of anxiety. And I think, again, it's a normal reaction to what to us as Americans is an unfamiliar and abnormal situation, which is a high level of uncertainty.
Dr. Nadal, given the position some people have as their profession, first responders or emergency room doctors, should there be ongoing awareness of this with them as just part of the job? I mean, occasionally they're reminded of PTSD and the symptoms to look for. And for that matter, patients who are brought in after traumatic accidents or experiences, should that be part of the treatment protocol?
Well, there is an awareness movement, which I'm very proud to be a member of, the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation. And that's a global movement to inform and educate first responders on identifying the physical, cognitive, emotional, behavioral, and even spiritual impact of being exposed to a disturbing and violent event, for example, the death of a child. And so there is a very very compact, concise debriefing model, which is basically a series of questions that in a safe, supportive environment that allows people who are in these professions to acknowledge and talk about what they're experiencing, what they're feeling, without understanding that this doesn't make you weak. Emergency room doctors who I've spoken to are aware of their own reactions. I think they tend to be pretty self-aware in general, and they're also aware of what they need to do to help patients get calm after a debilitating or life-threatening event or exposure witnessing something that was terrifying.
Dr. Lori Nadal is the author of Five Gifts, Discovering Hope, Healing, and Strength When Disaster Strikes. And again, this is PTSD Month. June is Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Awareness Month. Thank you for spending some time with our listeners today, Dr. Nadal.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Now the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A Creighton University economist says trade issues continue to impact the decisions of supply managers in the Mid-America region, and adding Mexico to the list of trade tariffs is further muddying the waters.
In this case, you're mixing politics and economics, and politics usually wins that one. And I think in this case, if that is implemented, politics will win, the economics will lose.
Dr. Ernie Goss conducts the Mid-America Business Conditions Index. The survey looks at purchasing decisions by supply managers in a 9-state region, which includes North Dakota. Goss says in the month of May, the survey numbers fell below growth neutral in 4 states, including North Dakota.
Iowa and Nebraska had a lot to do with flooding and some of the trade issues. Of course, North Dakota, some of the trade issues, but also oil prices now moving dramatically lower, and that's having some impacts on the oil industry and related industries in North Dakota and Oklahoma.
Goss says while volatility is expected with commodities such as oil and ag products, when you add trade issues to the mix, things ramp up quickly. Last week, the president announced a new round of tariffs, this time against goods imported from Mexico. Goss says it makes for tough going.
This could potentially undermine the passage of the USMCA. That's NAFTA 2.0, the next NAFTA. This, of course, got to be passed by Congress. And if that should go by the wayside, that the impacts would be tremendous and tremendously negative.
Goss says there are bright spots among all the dark economic clouds. He says unemployment is still low and consumer confidence is still high. What started as a small company from research done at NDSU will soon employ more than 1,000 people in Fargo. Aldevron is a biologic company. It manufactures gene therapy products used in treating some rare diseases. It'll be expanding in its Fargo campus to produce more product for the biopharmaceutical industry. Right now, it employs 300 people. Henry Hebel is Aldevron's chief operating officer. He says the demand for biologics is growing. He says Aldevron's customers are concerned about the quality, but also the timeliness of getting the products to the clinic.
This is the first time, really, in the history of medicine, we're talking about curing diseases, not just treating diseases. That's the type of product we work on. And so we take it very seriously and very personally to get these products to the clinic as quickly as possible because patients are waiting.
Ground for the new buildings will be broken in August, and the plan is to have them up and running by the year 2021. And school may be out for the summer, but this fall, students attending classes in West Fargo may be hitching a ride to school on the district's brand new all-electric school bus. The new bus is not only a first for the West Fargo Public School District, but also the state of North Dakota. Brad Redmond is director of transportation with West Fargo Public Schools. He says each year the district's fleet of school buses travel more than 750,000 miles to and from athletic and academic events, as well as on all 62 of its routes. The budget for the fleet is $4 million annually, and new buses are not cheap. Redmond says electric buses are more expensive than traditional buses, but over the next several years, they will conduct a study to determine the new bus's efficiency and cost effectiveness. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Josh Knutson. Josh is an esports and virtual reality solutions director for ByteSpeed, which is headquartered in Moorhead. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks,
Josh,
for having me. Great to be here.
This is an interesting job you've got. The job title I did a double take on. Let's do some definitions here. What are esports?
So esports, I guess the easiest way to describe them is a competitive video game played for some type of audience, typically at a professional level. So.
Well, you were formerly the head esports coach at the University of Jamestown, so
yep.
Describe that job.
Yeah, so in October of 2016, the University of Jamestown launched their esports program. It was an enrollment initiative to kind of bolster our offerings to our students, and I was fortunate enough to be asked to run that program. And, you know, we functioned almost exactly like a basketball team or a volleyball team. I recruited students. We renovated our facility. We had practices, games, and we're fortunate enough to have some really good success in those 3 years that I was there.
All right. So a brand new competitive sport at the college level. I assume you've played competitively.
Yeah, here and there. I didn't have an amazing professional career like some of the collegiate coaches out there, but I played in some semi-pro events before I was coaching. The thing with esports, to be able to have a career, it takes up a lot of time. And I was more focused on school, and I was a collegiate athlete, ran cross country and stuff. So I had a lot going on and couldn't focus on an esports career. But I definitely had a little bit of background, and I've been playing video games since I was 5 years old.
So, well, what makes somebody a good esports competitor?
I mean, definitely a good work ethic is first and foremost. I mean, something that can't be understated. To be able to get good at these games, you need to put in a lot of time, and you need to be motivated to not let the setbacks get to you. And there's some elements of being a professional esports athlete that you can't control. You know, with a sport like basketball, the rim is always the same size. The basketball is always the same size. But with esports, the rules can change every week. It's all up to the developer and how they balance the game and make it fair to those playing. And that changes the strategies that go along with it and kind of the way that you go about things. So definitely a good work ethic and the ability to stick with it when things don't go your way.
Pretty good reflexes too.
Yeah, you know, for some of those first-person shooter games or some of the MMOs and stuff like that.
What's an MMO?
An MMO is a large multiplayer online game, and MOBAs with League of Legends and stuff like that. Reaction time is important. So,
and when we talk about these multiplayer games, are we talking about some virtual basketball or some sort of hide-and-seek discovery game?
Yeah, I mean, more towards the fantasy type of element, or you know, games like Counter-Strike or Overwatch, they're first-person shooters. So you're playing for eliminations, kind of like, you know, if you were to play laser tag, you know, that's a great comparison.
So how would you describe the job of esports coaching?
Other duties as assigned is about 99% of it. it is one of the greatest jobs I think out there right now. Like traditional sports, you handle recruiting and retention of players, scheduling games and scrimmages, running practices, working with America's youth, which is always pretty awesome, being able to make those connections with, you know, 17, 18, 19-year-old kids and seeing them succeed. That was my favorite part of it. And then you're competing at a national level, and the way esports is set up right now, there's not a division tier. So, you know, little Jamestown, which is an NAIA school, is playing against Boise State University, who's the, you know, a giant Division I, and we beat them. So there's not many sports where you could have that kind of an outlook on things and that type of result. So it's kind of cool to be able to put everybody on the same playing field and be able to go out there and compete just with the best of the best of them.
Well, you mentioned you started this at University of Jamestown in 2016, and mm-hmm. it was looked at as a sort of a recruitment element, something to draw students to the campus. Was it successful?
Yeah. So when I left the university, we had a roster of 21 students, and I think about 19 of them came specifically for the esports program. And then I had a recruiting class of 10 more that were coming in for the fall of this year. So they're the Jamestown roster is going to be upwards of 30 new students that might not have come to the University of Jamestown. So when you're talking about a small school, that's a pretty big enrollment boost, and that's not atypical in the collegiate world.
So are lots of colleges and universities doing this now?
Yeah, absolutely. The growth of collegiate esports is kind of fun to see because it hasn't happened in a very long period of time. It's only been a few years. Robert Morris University is kind of looked at as the founder of collegiate esports. They started their program in 2014 and now are kind of looked at as the granddaddy of them all. And when we started in 2016, there were 20 schools at the varsity level in the U.S. and Canada that were a part of this National Association of Collegiate Esports. And that was in October of 2016. I checked this morning. There is now 150 schools in the U.S. and Canada that have varsity-level programs. So it's ballooned in 3 years from 20 to north of 150, and that's just varsity. There's so many other club teams and just, you know, groups of students that are doing student-run clubs at campuses. I mean, there's hundreds of schools that have some type of an esports program, and it's not stopping anytime soon.
And you don't need helmets or pads.
No, you just need some pretty good computers.
Okay, well, let's talk about the way the competitive sport is handled here.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm the only guy who's ever played the game, I'm going to be pretty good at it. So how are the games chosen for competition?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different ways that the nationwide competition is kind of set out. Typically, it is the developer of the game. So we could use League of Legends, for example. Riot is the company that creates League of Legends. They're based in California. They've created this game, and now they're going to run their collegiate competition. So they invite any school that wants to be a part of it. So you can have tournaments of, 10 all the way up to 400, if that's the way it plays out. And League of Legends is the world's number one played game. So you're going to have a lot of buy-in. And Riot kind of oversees the collegiate structure. It's based into conferences, Northeast, Southwest. And then there are a few NCAA conferences that have their own conference tournaments. The Big Ten is a great example of that, or the Peach Belt, which is a conference that Bytespeed actually works with directly. Those schools have their regular season play. It's usually about a 7-week, 8-week regular season. The top teams qualify for the last part of the national tournament. And typically there's a in-person final out in Los Angeles, or it kind of rotates around, and typically it's Los Angeles. And they're playing for a lot of scholarship money that the company Riot puts up for the winning schools. And it's kind of a really fun tournament to watch. It's a lot like March Madness.
Well, speaking of March Madness, is it possible to go from the collegiate level to the pros and make some real money?
Yeah, absolutely. Esports is kind of backwards in the way the professional scene was developed. I mean, when you think of how, like, basketball, for instance, you had your high school, then colleges started doing it, and then, all of a sudden the NBA was formed, or, your professional organizations were formed. Esports is kind of backwards, because there was a professional scene before there was a college, environment for esports. And there's definitely students that are talented enough and are looked at that are playing in colleges right now, and when they graduate, professional organizations are going to invite them to tryouts, and it's a multi-billion dollar industry if you lump everything combined. And those top-tier players that get those professional contracts, they can make a lot of money and have really successful careers.
What's good sportsmanship in an esports competition?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting thing, because a lot of what you do is online. We can play a full regular season without leaving our home facility. So like the good sportsmanship, typing good game in the chat, saying good luck, just not, being respectful in that manner of things. And Yeah, I mean, it's generally, try and stay away from that as much as possible, just like other sports. And actually the cool thing, when you do in-person tournaments, it's a lot like the hockey handshake line at the end of the game. The two teams they'll get up from their stations and they'll walk through and give you a handshake at the end of the game and say, good job and good luck with your next one. So it's a really good environment.
What's the spectator experience like here? Because you have audiences for
this. Yeah, absolutely. So it kind of varies based on when and where the game is played. If it's an online, regular season game, for example, a lot of it can be watched live streamed on the internet. So a couple of different places, YouTube or Twitch.tv is another website where a lot of stuff gets streamed to. It's kind of – Twitch was built to stream games so that other people could watch you play. And then there's – professional events and collegiate finals that are held in stadiums, and League of Legends is played in the Staples Center, and they sell out arenas for days on end with thousands of people watching, and it's pretty cool.
Well, I noted that there is a large arena that's in Anaheim, California,
yeah,
that is highly touted, and that there's some sort of a developing agreement with Walmart to provide these sort of arena environments in stores now.
Yeah, it the whole industry is ever evolving, and things like that are popping up all over the place. There's a place in town here in Fargo that's opening up as kind of an esports centered environment for people to come in and play and be able to, interact with people who care about the same thing as them. And the professional organizations and the professional leagues are always looking for partnerships to expand the experience to as many people as possible.
Do the fans cheer?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the cool things is, I don't know if you know what a thunder stick is, but it's two sticks of air you just clap together.
Oh, sure.
And they're super fun. A in-person event is unlike any experience you've ever been to.
Is there a home field advantage if I'm playing in an arena where a lot of the fans there are for me?
Definitely. You know, when you're on stage in front of people, the more people that are cheering and you know, there for you, it's just like any other sport. You know, that's going to motivate you and you're going to want to do better.
Well, you were recently hired by Morehead-based ByteSpeed as the company's eSports and Virtual Reality Solutions Director. Are there practical applications in the tech fields of skills that you learn playing these games?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, especially when you're talking about STEM and kind of the tech industries in general, being on a team gives you teamwork skills, communication skills, you're building critical thinking. You're exposed to that type of an environment. Those skills translate really, really well. Being able to know the ins and outs of a computer, or, you know, talking more on the hardware side, if you know what each part of the computer does, you know, you have an in kind of the tech industry to be able to have your foot in the door. And especially when you talk about, you know, game developers, the companies that are actually creating and maintaining these games that we're playing in esports, you know, there's tons of jobs that are opening up every day in that type of an industry. And, you know, if you have collegiate playing experience, that's going to give you an advantage if you're applying for those type of jobs.
Well, ByteSpeed, I went up on the website, that's B-Y-T-E, Speed, and has been providing customized computers for educational institutions and businesses and, you know, medical complexes. They do networking and support and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
This looks like a potential growth area.
Yeah, actually, you know, it's kind of a funny story of how ByteSpeed has changed on the esports side of things. We used to be, you know, like a consumer seller of custom computers. You know, Josh Knutson can go on their website and build a custom computer and have it, you know, and purchase that from ByteSpeed. And in 2016, when I was at Jamestown, we got a hold of ByteSpeed because they were a local tech company and they built computers. And we asked them, you know, what if we ordered the PCs for our esports team from you? Would that be something that you could do? And through that process, it kind of changed ByteSpeed's outlook on the whole esports industry to where now we're supplying high schools and colleges around the country with esports facility equipment, whether that be a PC, peripherals like a headset or a keyboard or a mouse, or furniture like desks and chairs. We've really evolved and kind of gotten our foot in the door as a direct competitor to a lot of those big companies like iBuyPower and Alienware and stuff like that, to be able to say, you know, hey, we have something special here in Morehead, and it really is kind of evolving to go along with that Silicon Prairie kind of idea.
Well, I used to be in higher education, and there was kind of a mantra in higher education that is reflected in this 2017 survey I came across from the World Economic Forum talking about the future of jobs. It says, quote, in many industries and countries, the most in-demand occupations or specialties did not exist 10 or even 5 years ago, and the pace of change is set to accelerate. By one popular estimate, 65% of children entering primary school today will ultimately end up working in completely new job types that don't yet exist.
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, technology changes and adapts so fast, and we oftentimes can't keep up. You know, the technology that we're working with on a daily basis, especially when you're talking virtual reality and esports, the performance of the computers, what it can actually do, and these app and game developers that are working on things that we could have never dreamed of. And it's really fun to be kind of at the front lines and see firsthand, you know, what's coming, and kind of be able to say that, yeah, that's something we want to jump on board with and follow and see where it goes.
Well, if I'm in the Indy 500, and I've watched it, I'm not in it, but or another kind of car race, there are specifications for the kind of engine or the kind of automobile I can race with. Is that the case in competitive esports?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the specs of your PC and what it can do and kind of the limits you can push it to definitely give you an advantage. If I've got a 10-year-old, you know, Dell desktop that's meant for, you know, a bank or a school that's been sitting there for 10 years, and I try and put that up against, you know, like one of the ByteSpeed computers that we build that has, you know, high quality parts that
they're
come
water
right
cooled
off,
sometimes.
Yeah, just off the shelf. I mean, the performance of the hardware is definitely going to give you an edge. And we're always looking for the next big thing and trying to see if it fits into what we want to build.
Well, in competitive athletics, there's sports betting. Is there sports betting around esports?
I mean, I'm sure there is. You know, I personally have not ever looked into it. But, you know, there's professional tournaments and professional seasons all over the place. And I would venture to say that there's probably some wagering that's going on those outcomes, and there's stuff going on all the time. So,
well, like the World Economic Forum said, looking ahead 5 to 10 years can be daunting given the rapid rate of change these days. But if you were looking ahead 5 or 10 years, where would you see esports?
Oh man, the possibilities are so endless. I mean, I've said for the last couple of years that by 2025, every school in the country, and you can include Canada with that too, you know, they're going to have an esports team, whether it's a club or a varsity program. And I just think that's going to be the standard.
It's a great incentive to learn about technology.
Absolutely. Yeah. It gives you a foot in the door with students who want to learn about that kind of thing. It gives you another opportunity to recruit students and retain students, because that's kind of like the buzzword in higher education now, is keeping the students that you bring in. And it's a great tool to be able to have on your campus. And I think it's as – you know, we get more accustomed to seeing it, it'll become the norm. And my hope is that, you know, in 5 or 10 years that we look at esports the same way we look at basketball, the same way we look at football. That was kind of always my dream and part of the reason why I wanted to get into esports in the first place.
What's unique about this, though, is that the game itself is different or changing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So do the esports competitors work with the gaming developers?
Not necessarily. It's more of the developers create a product and then we have to adapt to it.
Okay.
You know, a great example of this is when balance changes come out or patches that fix different bugs within the clients. And this is a lot of jargon, but basically, you know, imagine you're playing basketball. Say you're in a tournament. You have 4 games and halfway through the tournament, the official comes over to you and says, the 3-point line no longer exists. Deal with it. That's about what happens in esports. You know, rules change.
So you have to adapt.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is another skill.
Yeah, it's so different. But at the same time, you're using those skills the same way you would in traditional sports. And I think it's such a unique field, and it's growing, and it's not going to slow down anytime.
Well, your title is also Virtual Reality Solutions Director, and
yes,
esports can often be played, is often played with a virtual reality mask.
I mean, it can be. I think traditionally and the more common thing is just playing on a monitor.
Uh-huh.
But like I said, as technology grows, we're already seeing some virtual reality type esports being developed. There's not a real strong presence out there yet, but I know it's coming. And like you said, in 5 years, that could be the norm. We don't know. The technology is getting better every day. You know, companies like Oculus and Vive that are developing these headsets and pushing the tech as far as they can. They're coming out with, you know, wireless headsets now that perform just as well as the wired ones do. And it's not out of the question in 5 years to see esports being played on VR headsets.
And when you talk about virtual reality, it's not – perhaps out of the question that I'd be sitting in a Barco lounger at home with a virtual reality headset watching the next great big 3D movie instead of going to the Cineplex and sitting in a Dream Lounge.
Yeah, I mean, we have things already like YouTube VR that let you watch different programs through the virtual reality headsets. And, you know, we think about how far 3D has come in movies, you know, and virtual reality could be the next big thing.
Well, Josh Knutson is the Esports and Virtual Reality Solutions Director for Bitespeed Moorhead. It's a brave new world. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Decoded 8 Book is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 3rd. North Dakota remembers Theodore Roosevelt, featuring the words of Roosevelt as performed by Steve Stark. Theodore Roosevelt's residency in Dakota Territory began in June of 1884 when he saddled up for the life of a cowboy and rancher. In the wake of his wife and mother's same-day deaths, the despondent 24-year-old from New York found healing and solace in the Badlands and a lifetime connection with the people of the West.
My ranch house was built mainly by my guides, Bill Sewell and Will Dow, who, like most men of the Maine woods, were mighty with an axe. I could chop fairly well for an amateur, but I could not begin to do one-third of the work they could do. We began by cutting down our cottonwood trees. One time, I heard someone ask Dow what the total tree cut had been. Dow, not realizing that I was within hearing distance, replied, "Well, I cut down 53, Bill cut down 47, and the boss, Mr. Roosevelt, he beavered down 13. Those of you who have seen the stump of a tree gnawed down by a beaver will understand the full force of that comparison. Oh, I do not see how anyone could have lived more comfortably a life. We had bear skins and buffalo robes of our own killing and plenty to eat. Moreover, we had milk. I knew more than one ranch with 10,000 head of cattle, but not a single cow to be milked. We decided to be more enterprising and domesticate some of our wild cows. Our first effort was not successful. You see, to race a cow 2 miles at full speed on horseback, then rope her, throw her, turn her upside down, and milk her, while exhilarating as a pastime, is less than productive in actual results. Well, gradually we accumulated tame cows, and after we had thinned out the bobcats and the coyotes, more chickens. Oh, in that land we led a free and hardy life, and ours was the spirit of work and the joy of living.
Today's Dakota Datebook was written and performed by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota, this series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
That's the sound of people eating crickets.
It's just like chips, kind of.
It's earthy.
The more you look in his eyes, the less you want to eat it.
When we decide that something is edible, then it's okay to eat, and other cultures think differently about that.
Culture and the Psychology of Food, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Johnson & Johnson is one of America's most famous brand names, but in some circles, it has become famous for the wrong reasons.
We unequivocally believe that our talc, our baby powder, does not contain asbestos.
Now the healthcare giant is at the center of a trial in Oklahoma. It's accused of contributing to the opioid crisis. Can the company's reputation and its stock recover? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, Jamestown Arts was a recent winner of a Governor's Arts Award. And on Tuesday, we'll discuss the award, the association, and its summer arts market with Executive Director Mindy Schmitz. Harvest Public Media will report about a controversy over relocating federal agencies that track what farmers grow and what Americans eat. And we'll talk with ag risk consultant Angela Runyon about marketing crops. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.